From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Central Valley man who's an official in the Church of Scientology, plus how a computer operating system can inspire great enthusiasm in its users, and a new film tells the story of a local mountaineer who climbs cliffs without gear. First, worker-owned businesses. How do they operate? What are the pros and cons? A Sacramento man has studied cooperatives in the U.S. and overseas. He wrote an article about worker-owned businesses recently in SacramentoPress.com, and we'll discuss the topic on Monday in Davis. But right now, he's in our studio. Andrew McLeod, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Last October, you spent about 10 days in Spain studying what is probably the world's largest and best-known workers' cooperative, Mondragon.
Right.
What is that? Where is it?
It's located in the Basque Country, which is in northwestern Spain, right along the border with France. And it is a system that was originally developed in the mid-20th century. They were suffering from the aftermath of war and severe political repression. And a Catholic priest started working in the area and set up a trade school, which led to some of its early graduates starting a cooperatively owned stove factory to try to rebuild the economy. The way that they set this up was that the profits would go to the workers, but they would be pooled in a way that they would be available for investment in further businesses because they realized that it wasn't enough to just create one business. They needed to build a whole new economic system. And since then, it's expanded to over 100 cooperatives. They've got about 100,000 people working there. Roughly 40,000 of them are co-owners, and they're one of Spain's largest business enterprises.
And what kind of business lines do they work in?
Yeah, well, they get started in manufacture, and they do a lot of appliances and parts for vehicles. But they also do they create assembly lines for other factories. They have done extensive construction, including the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, and they have also developed the second largest grocery store chain in Spain with about. It's actually not a grocery store chain. It's a general retailer with about 2,400 locations.
How can we evaluate how successful this Mondragon cooperative is in Spain?
Well, I think one indication is that they have created an economy in the Basque Country that is roughly 40% more affluent on average than the rest of Europe and the rest of Spain. And they've done that without creating extremes of wealth and poverty. The Mondragon cooperatives have limits so that the top executives can only make 6 times the starting wage, and the CEO of the entire system can only make 9 times starting wage. Now, that's not all that's going on in the Basque Country. They only account for about 5% of the GDP, but they are part of a much larger cooperative movement that has tended to keep wealth distributed throughout the economy. Another really key achievement that they've had is that they have never had to lay off co-owners. They have had to lay off temporary workers at times, but they have managed to keep full employment throughout even Spain's worst economic times.
So not all the workers at Mondragon are owner workers.
That's right. And that's one of the big controversies about Mondragon. They have, in response to the opening of the Spanish economy and then of the European economy through globalization, they have created a network of subsidiaries that are worldwide. There's even one in the U.S. in Arkansas where they make Orbea bicycles. And they have... they've relied on these non-cooperative businesses as sources of revenue, sources of affordable components for their cooperatives.
This must create tension within the cooperative when you've got some workers are owners mm-hmm. and some workers are temps who can be laid off.
It does. And there's quite a bit of controversy around that. You actually will even see graffiti around town aimed at the cooperatives saying, you know, where's your solidarity? Because things are getting difficult over in Spain, and there have been some layoffs necessary.
We're talking about worker-owned businesses. My guest is Andrew McLeod. He's a cooperative development specialist, and he's studied worker-owned businesses overseas and in the U.S. We're talking specifically about Mondragon, which is a large and well-known workers' cooperative in the Basque Country of Spain. Andrew was there for about 10 days last fall. When a business is owned by the workers, who's in charge and who decides who tells people what to do? Because there has to be some of that in any business that involves more than one person.
There is. Well, there are many different ways that cooperatives can be run. Some of the smaller ones, particularly a lot of the worker cooperatives you find in the Bay Area, use what's called collective management, where larger decisions are made democratically by all the workers, in which there's no boss. In larger cases, and in some smaller cooperatives, you do have a typical management hierarchy in which the manager is basically, you know, directing how things are going to go. But the difference is that the manager is accountable to the workers. The workers are essentially their boss's boss. So there's sort of a circular power structure where if the manager is not doing a good job, then the workers can at some point, through their participation in the board, replace that management.
But doesn't that leave open the possibility of second guessing and politics behind the scenes? Because if you don't happen to like the job that your boss gave mm-hmm. you can undermine that person because you're an owner.
That's true. That there is a little bit of what we would think of as a conflict of interest there. And that's one of the tricks of worker cooperatives, that you have to develop systems in which people are able to, you know, change hats between being a worker and being an owner in different contexts, depending on what the subject is at a particular meeting or which meeting is happening.
You talked earlier about the ratio connecting starting salaries and top salaries mm-hmm. at Mondragon. And I can imagine that's attractive to some people, but to other people, they'll go, well, I could do exactly the same job somewhere else and make twice as much money. So why would I work at Mondragon?
Well, that's a good question. And I think that you have to ask people, well, what are their motives? You know, are they interested in creating a sustainable economy in which there's enough for people to live on? Or are they interested in what's happening in our economy in which there's greater and greater concentration of wealth?
How do we know that a worker-owned enterprise is more likely to create that sustainable economy where there's a higher level of employment and maybe even satisfaction mm-hmm. as opposed to at a regular business that's privately held?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
I should correct that.
Yeah.
A worker-owned enterprise is also privately held.
It is.
But is owned by a small group of people as opposed to the workforce as a whole.
Well, I mean, I don't think you can generalize that every cooperative is better than every other business. But I think that when you do have some degree of control and some degree of profits being circulated back into the workforce through profit sharing, you're going to tend to have a business that makes decisions that are more in the interest of the community and more in the interest of its workforce. And that's going to lead to, generally speaking, better morale, lower turnover, and so forth. And this has been borne out in a number of studies and a number of anecdotal cases, both in the U.S. and abroad.
You're an independent contractor. Have you ever worked in a cooperative?
I have. I got my start in a cooperative in Minneapolis called the New Riverside Cafe, which was a worker-owned, democratically managed restaurant. And I probably worked in close to a dozen different cooperatives over the years.
Oh, I think I've been in that cafe, actually.
You might have.
In Minneapolis,
yep.
Yeah.
It's not around anymore, but it was quite an institution for a number of decades.
And what was it like for you working there?
It was interesting. That was a co-op that had already been around for about 25 years, and it was sort of on a downward slope at that time. Its business was struggling. And it was challenging. I won't say that it wasn't, because it was, there were a lot of frustrating elements about it. But I sensed that there was something very important going on. Even though we weren't doing it quite right, in my opinion now, we were still doing actual democracy on a day-to-day basis, which I think is essential, because we're seeing a breakdown in our democratic process on all levels, just in terms of participation, in terms of there's a lot of shifting in terms of how Congress is doing things around whether or not, particularly around the healthcare reform. There's been a lot of process controversy. And, I think that we need to be looking for models for how do we create a higher level of democratic competency in citizens. And participation in cooperatives is a great way to do that.
Well, with hindsight, how should things have been run more efficiently at the cafe, the cooperative cafe where you worked in Minneapolis?
Yeah, well, I think the big problem, and this is not the only place where I've seen this, is that that collective did not delegate things effectively. So you wound up having a lot of fairly small decisions being made by a large group of people. And I think it's very appropriate to make big decisions as a whole group and have everybody empowered in, you know, larger issues of, okay, do we, you know, what is our pay ratio? That type of thing, I think, is appropriate. But when you start getting into a situation where everybody is talking about whether, you know, the border on a certain ad should be green or red, that's where it really breaks down.
Well, I'm sure I have personally, and I'm sure many people listening right now have also experienced that in non-cooperative run businesses. So that's not limited to cooperatives.
Absolutely.
You also, late last year, toured some parts of the United States looking at cooperatives there in old industrial cities.
I did.
What did you find? Anything of particular interest?
I did. One of the most interesting places that I visited was in Cleveland. The Cleveland Foundation has launched what's called the Evergreen Initiative, and they are consciously emulating Mondragon. They've sent a couple of delegations over there now, including people from the mayor's office, from a number of large community institutions. And what they are doing is channeling the purchasing power of large community institutions like hospitals and schools into locally owned cooperative businesses. They've already opened the greenest industrial laundry in the country and a solar panel company. And next year, they're planning to open a 5-acre greenhouse to grow lettuce and herbs right in Cleveland. So that's one thing that's very interesting. I was also very interested to note that based in Pittsburgh, you have the United Steelworkers, and they have signed a contract or an agreement in principle with Mondragon to create worker cooperatives in North America.
So the union is interested in creating worker cooperatives.
Exactly. Like they've recognized that there are limitations to organizing in shrinking industries, and they need to actually pursue creating jobs. And there's a long history of unions and cooperatives being involved, being collaborators in the past. The Knights of Labor were particularly active in that. But there have also been a lot of other unions that have, in many cases, created cooperatives during strikes, both to provide people with their basic food needs and also, in some cases, to compete with their old owners. And I should mention that I believe that Capital Co-op CAB was actually created out of a strike.
Are there many co-ops in the Sacramento area? A lot of people will be familiar with the Sacramento and Davis food co-ops. Other than them, what is there? Is there much?
There are. We're not one of the big hotbeds. I'd say San Francisco has a lot more than we do. In the Sacramento area, you have quite a few credit unions, including Golden One and Safe and Teachers. You also have a couple of large agricultural co-ops, including Blue Diamond and Farmers Rice Cooperative. And then there are even cooperative housing, both a housing co-op in South Sacramento called Flora and Gardens, and then the Mutual Housing Association, which is a little bit different model, but it's a cooperative type of housing. And then finally, I just recently learned that there's a biodiesel purchasing co-op in town.
Is there a trend towards co-ops, either in Sacramento or in the U.S., or is there a trend away from them?
I think there's definitely a trend toward them right now. Co-ops tend to happen when there are market failures, when there isn't enough of a profit motive to get certain key services and products to people, and eventually people turn to more cooperative forms of organizing. You're seeing a lot of this in particularly in smaller communities that are losing their grocery stores or their department stores in rural areas, especially in Montana, Wyoming, Kansas, those sorts of areas. And in Sacramento, I mean, there's a big conversation around creating local markets that's being led by Valley Vision, and it's the Food System Collaborative is what it's called. And they have a new website that just went up this week at foodsystemcollaborative.org. And they're really looking into different local markets. They're not specifically looking at cooperatives, but I see a lot of opportunity for that because in addition to just simply creating ways of growing the food, I think that you need to find ways of making that local food affordable to people. by creating jobs, and cooperatives seem to be a very good way of doing that.
Finally, Andrew McLeod, you live in Sacramento, but you're leaving soon to go to D.C. to take a job in the cooperative line?
It's true. I just got a job offer a couple of days ago with the National Cooperative Business Association, and I'll be working with them starting in a couple of weeks.
And is that a cooperatively organized association?
They are organized along cooperative lines. They're not a co-op themselves. I believe they're a 501c6, but they represent all different types of co-ops throughout the U.S.
Well, enjoy D.C. and enjoy the job.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Andrew McLeod. For now, a Sacramento man who studied worker-owned businesses overseas and in the U.S. He wrote about this recently in sacramentopress.com. He's talking about it Monday evening at the Davis Food Co-op Teaching Kitchen. It starts at 6 o'clock. It's in Davis, of course. And he's a cooperative development specialist. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, you'll meet a man originally from Stockton who's an NFL veteran and now an official in the Church of Scientology. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If you want real-world experience to help your career, consider applying to becoming an Insight intern. You'll find details on the careers page at capradio.org. Coming up in Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 50 years ago, Ted Maimon shined a flash lamp into a ruby crystal and out came a laser beam. We'll look at the sometimes controversial history of the laser. Plus, how TV could shorten your lifespan. Also, can you look at someone's genes and tell what race they are? That's Science Friday after Insight at 11 on Capital Public Radio. One of the world's most controversial churches is Scientology. Founded by the writer L. Ron Hubbard, Scientology is probably best known for its celebrity practitioners and its opposition to psychiatric drugs. There's also a widespread belief here and overseas that Scientology is a money-making cult, not a religion. Joining us to discuss all this is a formerly Stockton man who's an official in the Church of Scientology. Bob Adams is an alumnus of University of the Pacific and an 8-year veteran of the National Football League. He's now vice president of the Church of Scientology International. Bob Adams, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey. I really appreciate it. And I definitely do miss the Central Valley. It was one of the most fun places as a kid. I didn't grow up there all my life, but I was a Bay Area resident and then came up and went to UOP, University of the Pacific, and had a wonderful time there.
Why is the church called Scientology? The name suggests scientific teachings, but the church's main positions are called a creed, which is an expression of faith.
Yes, well, Scientology, broken down, is ology is a study of, as in biology and so forth. But the first part of the word, scion, actually comes from the Greek skio, which means wisdom or truth in the fullest meaning of the word. So it is the study of wisdom or study of truth, and that is really the basis of all of Scientology, whether it be counseling or education. It is studying truth so that it can be applied to life and livingness and improve one's conditions for oneself, for family, for group, for mankind as a whole. So all of our programs are basically built around that whole notion of better understanding, more truth applied, and getting rid of the lies that would, of course, defeat one's efforts in life to achieve one's goals and purposes.
Now, in the United States, the church is, at least for tax purposes, considered to be legally a religion. But in other countries, it's not. Why do you think the religious status of Scientology is a subject of so much dispute?
Well, that's true with many of the world's minority religions. They don't necessarily have the government's official sanction and maybe not have charitable status, but we are not prohibited to practice Scientology in any country. We have religious recognition in recently in as much as Spain with full charitable status, Portugal, South Africa, full charitable status. Australia was the first country that recognized Scientology officially and actually became the definition of church or religion as it applied to Scientology applies now to all the Commonwealth nations. And so we set the standard as far as what a religion is, and we're recognized in 36 countries fully, and we have our charitable status in many other countries. The U.S. in 1993, full charitable status as well as recognition, not just for the church, but for all the church's social betterment programs, which now constitute in 165 countries, but they constitute over 8,000 groups worldwide. That includes churches, missions, and social improvement or social betterment programs, and so forth. So we are recognized and we are used, and not from practicing in the majority of the countries of the world. We're in 165 countries, so that kind of states it as a statistic.
Bob Adams, Vice President of the Church of Scientology International. He's an alumnus of University of the Pacific. The founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, was also a fairly well-known writer, mainly of science fiction, but pulp fiction in general. He even wrote some romance books. And he wrote the book Dianetics, The Modern Science of Mental Health, which, as far as I can tell, is really more of a self-help book. But that seems to have been the foundation of the religion. Was it Hubbard's intention to create a religion out of that?
Not originally. He wrote the book as a self-help, but it was also he also had what was called group Dianetics, which is that the principles found in Dianetics can be applied to family, to groups of any kind or any size. But it was primarily for helping people get a handle on what the mind actually is and that something could be done about it in terms of a common sense therapy that could be done by two people in the quiet of their home or office, where they could get some remedy from the stresses of life. And it's very simple. You know, Dianetics is not complicated. It is all-time bestseller in the self-help area for the mind. And it continues to sell at an incredible rate, and it has a lot to do with the marked expansion of the Church of Scientology just in the last several years. The expansion is exponential, and really the result are that doubling just in the number in the last 5 years of the number of nations and groups is because Scientology works, and Dianetics has been around since 1950, and it has proven very workable. And by word of mouth, for the most part, that's what is the cause of the expansion of Dianetics, as well as the Church of Scientology.
Now, that financial success of Dianetics, the book, tied with the fees that, as I understand, are charged to people who are going through Scientology practices, all of that feeds a widespread belief among non-Scientologists that it's a cult, that it's some kind of scam even. How do you respond to that, which you've probably heard many times?
Well, if that were true, I mean, we have government examinations. I mean, they would be the first ones to, and they were when they examined the church in 1993, found it to be completely in line with all tax policies, with all business practices. There's nothing there. That's just, all that is rumor mongering to try to point the person's attention away from our expansion and all the good things that Scientology does in the community with its humanitarian programs and stick it on a hot subject such as money or taxes, however they want to apply it. But really, the true story, the real story, is Scientology's expansion and what it does to help communities and individuals have better lives, more productive lives, to live the life and follow those aims and goals that they have, and bring about a change in society for the better. I mean, Lord knows we need some improvements in our culture, and Scientology is a leader in those, such as drug addiction or handling drug addiction, improving drug awareness on all sides of the coin, helping in understanding human rights. We have the world's largest human rights program, non-governmental, in the world today. We have a volunteer organization with over 200,000 volunteers worldwide, many of them now on their way to Haiti to help in that situation. They responded to Katrina. They responded to the tsunami. This is what Scientology is all about, and its application of its technologies in helping people find happiness, find truth. And that's really the story of Scientology, let alone its exponential expansion, primarily due to word of mouth.
Is there a god or some godlike figure at the center of Scientology that people usually find in a religion?
We definitely believe in God. And we believe that man is a spiritual being, number one, that he is his own immortal soul. He has a body, and he has a mind. And if that mind is giving him trouble, we have therapeutic techniques such as Dianetics and self-awareness processes, which are our spiritual counseling, to help the person overcome the obstacles in their life. But Scientology really addresses the individual and their immediate environment to help them better understand life from the context of a spiritual being. And all Scientology does is to really, not all, but what Scientology does, help that individual realize the potential of themselves as a spiritual being. And the individual, as far as the specific God is concerned that they would address or pray to, would be their own choice. That's why a person from any religion could study Scientology. It doesn't change their belief system of the religion that they would originate from, but it might alter their perception of themselves as a spiritual being and to help them realize more of their full potential. That's what Scientology can do when applied to one's life, and that's really the essence of Scientology. It's to improve awareness of self and others and to help themselves and others achieve their own spiritual awareness and to get along in life and be successful.
Bob Adams is Vice President of the Church of Scientology International. I was reading the Creed of the Church of Scientology this morning, and a lot of it reads more like a declaration of rights rather than a statement of faiths or beliefs that one finds in a religion. But there are two elements that really stood out for me. One was that all men have inalienable rights to the sanity, and also the laws of God forbid man to destroy the sanity of another. And I don't think I've ever read the word sanity in a religious creed before. Why the interest in sanity in Scientology?
Well, all men deserve the rights, inalienable rights to their own sanity is fairly straightforward. In other words, if you have conditions, planet Earth or in various societies, that torture men or women or children to the point where they do lose their sanity, and believe me, it has happened throughout history. It's very well documented. Even today, in this country and other countries, torture is a violation of basic human rights. It's a violation of the tradition of our basically any religious lore that man deserves and has a right to his sanity, and that sanity should not be taken away and driven from him by and through torture or drugs or electric shock or other forms of brutal techniques to try to resolve a person's problems in their mind. What we're saying here is all people, regardless of their state of sanity, deserve to be treated with humane processes and humane techniques to help them achieve their sanity back, to regain their sanity.
Are you saying that psychiatric drugs are a form of torture or are inhumane?
Psychiatric drugs, if you look at the evidence and the data, and the Church of Scientology doesn't prescribe drugs. It doesn't say don't take drugs. It says refer to your doctor. But we're not against medications. We're against harmful drugs that have been proven to be harmful to a person's sanity and their spiritual awareness and their overall happiness. And if you look at the side effects of psychiatric drugs, it's multiple pages. You look at any magazine and look up the antidepressants today, which have black box labels on them showing that they're not only harmful, but they can bring about suicidal ideation, which is the idea of pain.
But you could say the same about all kinds of physical drugs, too. I mean, you find boxes like that attached to all kinds of medications.
Well, not in the case of mind-altering psychotropic drugs. When you take a drug for a kidney problem or a stomach problem, you're not at all affecting the person's perception of who or what they are or whether or not they're depressed or more depressed because they've taken a drug that depresses them. We are looking at thousands of cases. The FDA has looked at thousands of cases where the human mind has been damaged by these psychotropic drugs, and it destroys a person's sanity and can. It doesn't say it does it in every case, but it does, and it can harm the individual. So the church doesn't have a position on medicating. It just has a position per its creed not to destroy, that a person has inalienable rights to their own sanity. And if you have something in the culture that could be causing a person to become less lucid and act more insane or in this case just their behavior problems become more severe, then I think the society should look at that hard, including the FDA, including government, and examine it. I mean, there's been enough congressional and senatorial investigations on psychotropic drugs to fill a library. This is an ongoing examination, and more evidence is coming out.
Okay,
so it is – I mean, isn't it a natural instinct in mankind to help another person be optimum in their condition and their sanity? Because they're going to make either irrational or rational decisions. And those rational decisions are important for our survival, and the irrational decisions are contrary to survival. And that is when you get into the shaded area of insanity, and we all suffer when other people
okay, Bob,
act insane.
We'll need to move on. I mean,
that's okay.
You could also be applying rather a broad brush here to a whole scope of drugs that are used to talk about mental illnesses. But let's wrap this up. You're traveling to Stockton to attend your college roommate's induction to the UOP Sports Hall of Fame. Who is this, a football player?
He was a football player at UOP. He was a coach at Delta College, very successful, and also the athletic director. His name's Gary Scott, a dear friend. I've known him since high school, early days of high school. He is majorly, he's Native American. And he's very proud to be, and I'm proud that he is, and he's a wonderful guy, and he deserves every bit of his receipt of this induction into the UOP Hall of Fame. He's been a real tribute to UOP and society as a whole. He's a wonderful man, and he has two great children and wife, and he deserves every bit of this.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Bob Adams, he's Vice President of the Church of Scientology International. He's an alumnus of University of the Pacific and a former player, a tight end in the National Football League. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeffrey. I appreciate being on and the time to spend with you.
Thank you. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local mountaineer who climbs without gear. His story is told in a film. We'll be right back. Listen to Insight live online at capradio.org/insight. First Ascent, Alone on the Wall, is a new film about a Sacramento man who's made a name for himself climbing steep cliffs without gear. It's a type of climbing called free solo. The film about Alex Honnold shows this weekend at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival in Nevada City. He joins us. Alex, welcome to Insight.
Hello.
Why do you climb cliffs without gear?
That's kind of a big question. There are a lot of reasons. I don't know. It's really fun for one thing. On easy routes, it's just a lot faster. It's just a fun way to climb.
It's faster.
Yeah, much faster. I mean, at least twice as fast because you don't have a partner. Normally, you take turns, so you climb and then you bring up your partner, and then you climb and then you bring up your partner. So if you have no partner, you go at least twice as fast.
Okay, so it's fun and it's faster, but isn't it also more dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's quite a bit more dangerous. But on routes that are really easy, it doesn't really make that big a difference. And then on harder routes, you just have to accept, you know, an added level of risk.
When you say it's fun, what is fun about it?
I think just the freedom of movement, the being able to move up and down at whatever pace you want. Normally, you're held back by a rope and gear, and you have to place gear into the rock as you go to protect yourself. So when you don't have a rope or gear, you're just much more free. You can sit down wherever you want. You can like wander up and down. You know, if you get bored, you can like just climb back down and call it a day. Like,
is the added level of danger also part of the fun?
Certainly on the harder routes, it is. I don't know if it's part of the fun, but it's part of what makes the experience so powerful, I guess.
My guest is Alex Honnold. He's a Sacramento man who climbs cliffs without gear. He's featured in the new film First Ascent, Alone on the Wall. You can see it this weekend in Nevada City at the Environmental Film Festival. Did you start out climbing regular style with all the gear and with a partner and so on?
Yeah. I actually started at a gym in town with my dad. We just climbed indoors for years and years. So that's about as safe as it gets, climbing indoors, you know.
And what gave you the idea to start climbing without gear? Did someone tell you about it, or did you just think, you know, I'd like to try this without anything?
There's actually a fairly like rich history of free soloing in California. There are many of like the most visionary climbers from the 70s and 80s were into soloing. Just like within the history of climbing, there's a lot of soloing going on, and so I mean I've known about it ever since like I was climbing in the gym. And then, and just California in particular, just the nature of the climbing around here, it's all large, like, granite cliffs. So the rock tends to be extremely solid, so it's safe to solo on, like, because the rock won't break under you.
Oh.
So just kind of the nature of where I live and, like, the history that I grew up in is just, I don't know, it's just a natural progression.
Do you ever climb with gear? Are there any?
Yeah.
You do?
Of course. I mean,
what's the difference?
You know,
why do you decide in some cases you're going to use gear?
Well, I mean, I use gear like 99%, you know, all the time, basically. Like, soloing is just kind of a special occasion that you do every once in a while. It's kind of fun. It's something to dabble in on the side. But, I mean, normally I climb with a rope. Like, I mean, my climbing is totally safe, you know, except for every once in a while.
Well, but again, what's the difference? Why do you decide in some cases that you're going to climb without gear?
I don't know. It's hard to say. Sometimes you just get in your head that you want to solo something. And, I mean, it's a whole different experience. Like, normal climbing is just fun. You go out, it's safe. You go with your friends. It's whatever. Like, I mean, I do that pretty much every day all year. Soloing is more just something you do for yourself from time to time because for whatever reason you get excited about a certain route.
Is it mentally more challenging?
Yeah. Yeah, quite a bit.
You must, the level of focus that you must keep must be intense.
Yeah. Especially on harder routes. Well, that's the thing. I keep drawing a line between hard soloing and easy soloing, because easy soloing, like when a route is physically easy, it's just a pleasure. Like, it's just romping. Like, it's just a lot of fun. But hard soloing is what you're talking about, where you have to stay mentally super focused for up to hours at a time. And that can be pretty challenging.
But how do you keep that focus?
I guess
the prospect of falling 100 feet helps.
Well, or thousands of feet, yeah.
Thousands.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the risk helps keep you focused. But honestly, it gets a little challenging after a while to concentrate as hard as you can on something for, like.
What about physically? Is it also physically more demanding?
No, physically it's technically a little bit easier because you don't have the weight of the rope holding you back. Normally, when you consider, like, a rope will weigh like 8 to 10 pounds or something. So, like, you know, you have a little bit of weight hanging off you. You have the gear hanging off you. You have to, like, stop climbing to place gear every once in a while. So,
but isn't there also a tendency to want to grip harder because the stakes are so much higher?
Yeah,
And that would be more tiring.
But but that's a mental thing that you have to overcome. Like, in order to solo well, you have to leave that behind and just relax. Like, that's the beauty of soloing. When you're soloing well, you're climbing perfectly. You're climbing exactly how you should be with the rope on, but just without the rope. And so it's a great feeling when you do it right.
Have you ever been in a situation where you thought you were going to lose it?
Not really. Probably not, like, where I honestly thought I was about to pitch. But, you know, I mean, I've had little moments of terror where, like, you know, something breaks or, like, a bird or a bat will come out of a crack, like, right in front of you. And, like, you put your hand into a crack and all of a sudden a bat, like, hisses at you or something. You know, just middle, like, oh, my God, where you get really scared for a second. But,
and if you had ropes and so on, then that wouldn't be much of a problem.
Well, if you had ropes, you'd probably still be kind of scared when you hear something, like, shriek at you out of the crack. But you wouldn't be looking at the same consequences if you fell off, you know.
What's the difference between free soloing and bouldering?
It's kind of a matter of degrees, actually. Bouldering is the same thing. You're just climbing rocks without a rope. But the difference is that bouldering generally refers to just a boulder, which is normally up to maybe 20 feet high. But actually, nowadays, people are kind of pushing the limits of bouldering into the realm of soloing, you know. Bouldering, like, 40-foot boulders. So, I mean, really, like, you can't really fall from the top of a 40-foot boulder. You'll break your legs, you know.
You're featured in this film, First Ascent Alone in the Wall, which is made by Nick Rosen and Pete Mortimer. How did that come about? Did you know them, or did they know you? Did they hear about you?
I knew them. I mean, I've watched all their movies, you know. They made other climbing movies that, and, I mean, I watch all climbing media just because it's kind of exciting. But yeah, so I knew them, and I'd already soloed the movie shows me soloing a couple of different routes. Like, I'd already soloed those the year before, because normally when I solo, it's just for myself, whatever, you know. I go out and just do some soloing. And then I went back with them to shoot it the next year because they had, you know, because they wanted to make a movie out of it.
Have you seen the film?
Yeah.
What do you make of it?
It's good. I don't know.
But do you look at yourself and go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing that?
No, not really. I mean, when I watch the movie, I just think of when I was shooting it with them, because to me there's a big difference between when I was shooting all the footage and when I actually soloed them the first time. And shooting the footage is just a lot of fun, you know, because you're climbing it again, but there's also somebody hanging right next to you with the camera and you can chat with them, and it's just, you know, just a bunch of dudes out having a good day.
Alex Honnold, he climbs cliffs without gear, just Most of the time he climbs with gear, but sometimes he free solos. And he's featured in the film First Ascent, Alone on the Wall. It shows this weekend at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival in Nevada City. You can see it on Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, you might have heard of Linux, but you don't really know what it is. We'll explain when we come back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Capital Public Radio and the Sacramento Bee are teaming up for a big collaboration called The Road to Recovery. Reporters will tell the stories of industries and individuals around the region who are pulling us out of the Great Recession. You'll find The Road to Recovery on air, online, and in the paper. Sunday in The Bee starts then, and Monday during Morning Edition here on Capital Public Radio. Most personal computers use Windows as their operating system, the software that controls the computer. But there are other operating systems, and one has a surprisingly passionate following. It's called Linux, and it's an example of so-called open source software. What exactly is Linux and open source software? Why are some people so enthusiastic about it? A local Linux users group is about to celebrate its birthday. Two members join us. We'll start with co-founder and president Bill Kendrick. Bill, welcome to Insight.
Hi, thanks for having us.
It's an unusual name, Linux, L-I-N-U-X. Why is it called that?
So the person who first started developing it, his name is Linus or Linus, and it is kind of a re-implementation of a Unix-style operating system. So somebody joked that you should name it Linus with an X at the end. So.
But it's usually pronounced Linux, although I've heard people say Linux as well.
He is a Finnish. Yeah, Swedish-speaking Finn. So yeah, he pronounces his name Linus. So I guess if you want to be pedantic, you could call it Linux.
Yes. And you are a software developer, both professionally and a hobbyist. Do you work exclusively with Linux as a software developer?
These days, yes.
Also with us is Margot Schulter, who is, I guess an occasional member of the Linux Users Group of Davis, which is about to celebrate its 11th anniversary. Margot, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
What is your connection to Linux? You're not a professional software developer. You do it more as a hobby.
Yes. Well, I guess I'm a user, and of course I use it for various purposes. One of the purposes, of course, is just my everyday life of writing, because I sometimes do advocacy in different areas, and I use Emacs, which is just an absolutely wonderful word processing and potentially typesetting application if you use a typesetting language. And also I use a program called Ecosound to record pieces in medieval and Renaissance styles, which I actually record from a hardware synthesizer. And I think the sound support in Linux with the ALSA library and so forth was one of the things that really drew me into the system.
So you turned to Linux because it offered features when it came to recording that you were not finding on Windows?
Well, actually, I've never used Windows, honestly, except occasionally when I'm at the university and I used their web access. But I was using MS-DOS. I was using MS-DOS 6.22 until 2004.
Which some listeners might be going, MS-DOS, what's that? That's the operating system on PCs that predated Windows but came from Microsoft.
That's correct. Because I think just given the way that I work, I do better with numbers or letters than I do with a visual environment often. And so DOS, of course, really was no longer actively supported in that form after 1994. So I sort of spent 10 years in an interesting world. And of course, there was a migration process, because in 1996, I got on the internet and I got a Unix shell account. So I discovered this wonderful Unix. And also, it turned out there was the wonderful set of utilities called DJGPP, developed by DJ DeLory, which was sort of an implementation of a lot of the GNU software shared with Linux.
And we're getting a bit too technical here, I think, for the general audience. Bill Kendrick, why not use Windows or the Macintosh operating system? Why use something else called Linux?
Well, when I first got a PC, which was admittedly right after I graduated with a computer science degree, if that makes any sense, I couldn't afford a Mac. I really liked the Macs and the Apple software, but I couldn't afford the hardware. And based on using Windows on my friend's PC and elsewhere, I really didn't like it. It wasn't stable. I lost a lot of work trying to use it. It was just kind of a frustrating to use environment. And, talking about MS-DOS, Windows, especially back then, had so much of its roots in MS-DOS. It was really just kind of this layer on top of it. And I'd been using a lot of Unix at school. And when I discovered that there's this thing called Red Hat Linux that you can get for a PC, I said, oh, man, that's exactly what I need. So that's how I kind of first got into the Linux environment, was discovering there was an alternative to the expensive Mac, to the not very good Windows, and to the extremely expensive Unix that they ran at school.
We're talking about the Linux operating system. The Linux Users Group of Davis is about to celebrate its 11th anniversary. Linux is often described as open source software. What does that mean?
That means that it's both free of cost and access to the source code is made available. So anyone who wants to pick up a piece of open source software and change its behavior, fix a bug, spin off a completely new application, or fork is what they call it, based on the existing code, is free to do that.
But doesn't that run the risk of undermining the operating system itself? If anyone can tinker with it, aren't there possible problems coming from that?
If you're talking about in terms of security, yeah, in some ways.
Well, not just security, but stability as well.
Yeah, definitely. But it's I always kind of describe it like you go to the store and there's 50 different versions of toothpaste. Do you really go, man, why do there need to be so many different versions of toothpaste? When really you're going, oh boy, Spearmint, that's my favorite. So with Linux and with open source, in a lot of ways you end up with a choice. But not only that, also the recipe. So if you want to make your own different flavored toothpaste at home, that's kind of what it gives you.
Does this mean you have to be a gearhead, you need to be a software developer to use Linux, or can someone who knows nothing about computers actually somehow get Linux and have it run on their computer without problems?
Well, I would never promise anyone running anything on a computer without problems.
Good point.
But, a few decades ago when Linux was first coming to be, definitely you needed to be a gearhead. These days, it's extremely simple to install an operating system like Ubuntu. Linux is a really popular one these days, on a PC, and have a full desktop environment and do a lot of the day-to-day stuff that you normally do. And at the same time, also have access to, kind of at the touch of a button, literally tens of thousands of other applications, which is something that like Windows and Mac don't actually get. It's kind of like the App Store on an iPhone, except for it's on a PC, and we've had this for years under Linux.
Does someone own Linux? Does someone get money if you run Linux on your computer?
No. There's an organization that owns a trademark. But aside from that, really, there are a number of businesses that take advantage of Linux or sell versions of Linux or sell support on top of Linux. But really, no, you can come to one of our meetings and we've got literally free disks. We'll give it to you. You take it at home, put it on your computer.
And can you run it on a PC or a Mac?
Yes. You have to get the right version for the Mac hardware, I think.
Doesn't the computer want to explode or reject it?
No, not usually.
Not usually.
No more than Windows or Mac.
Margot, do you tinker with Linux yourself? Do you make your own flavors of Linux or your own applications, your own programs to run on Linux?
Honestly, for the most part, I have not reached that level. But of course, to clarify what I was saying before, I think that it's wonderful the way there are a vast number of people who have. I think the generosity of the open and free software community, which we've been discussing, is incredible, because you may have various needs that are not the most typical on the mass market, but the chances are there may well have been someone who's done it. I guess for me, I do have, I have at times been involved in programming in the PostScript language to design graphics. But I've not really tinkered that much with the operating system itself. I pretty much take it as there and run my applications and things.
Bill Kendrick, that leads me to my final question to you, which is why do so many Linux users feel so passionate about it? I mean, I don't think people have that sense of attachment to Windows, maybe a bit more so to the Mac, but even there, it's not the same as Linux.
I think there's a level of ownership that people feel in it. Because it is, for the most part, a giant global volunteer effort, you become kind of a volunteer. Like, I am one, I guess, locally, as well as globally with the open source software that I do myself. It just seems kind of like the right thing to do, to create something that people in the future can use without necessarily being tied to a corporation or to a company. It's it's a movement, I guess, you'd say.
And that open source software movement seems connected to a general trend in the technology movement when you think about social media, user-generated content, Wikipedia, all that sort of thing. Is it all somehow connected, part of the zeitgeist, I guess you could say?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Bill Kendrick is co-founder and president of the Linux Users Group of Davis, about to celebrate its 11th anniversary. If people are interested in going, when do you meet?
We will be meeting at the Veterans Memorial Center in Davis on East 14th Street. That's going to be at 7 p.m. on Monday, January 18th, and we meet once a month.
That's Bill Kendrick. Margot Schulter is also a Linux user. Margot, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight's theme is composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Today's associate producers, Lynn Weaver and Jason Kanger. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Evan Matzler. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our executive producer is Carl Watanabe. Thank you for joining us.